We continue the theme of matchmaking on Valentine's Day with one reporter's experience covering the inner workings of love and marriage in India. 10 years ago, reporter Elizabeth Flock was fresh out of college and she just moved to Mumbai.
I ended up living with a number of different Indian families, and that is sort of how I got interested in the Indian marriage. I also had moved to Mumbai after my father's third divorce, so I think I was interested in why marriages work or fail.
So she began a decade of reporting on three middle-class Indian marriages and got intimate access to everything from text messages to legal documents. And in her new book, The Heart is a Shifting Sea, Love and Marriage in Mumbai, she documents the lives of these couples. And she says part of what she found was an India that's changing for women.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you, you focus in your book on three couples. Why did you choose these three couples? What was it that they represented either about love or about love in Mumbai, particularly that really drew you to them?
Well, I was especially interested in looking at the middle class because as I say in the book, the middle class doesn't have the moral freedom of, I think, sometimes the very rich or the very poor. There's this concept of middle class morality in many countries, which is sort of the idea that you cannot transgress certain boundaries because people will talk or there will be repercussions. And at a time of so much social and cultural and political and economic change in India, I really wanted to understand how that was placing pressure on people and on relationships and on marriages. And I saw that playing out the most within the middle class, where, you know, Indian women are gaining so much more agency. There's so many more women in India going to work, getting educated, maybe deciding to watch pornography, engage in affairs. All of these things are happening while at the same time, a lot of the old rules have not changed. A lot of the expectations of parents, in-laws, neighbors, the wider community, husbands. And so that tension that's sort of playing out is something that I was really interested in looking at. And all three of these couples, to me, were a really good example of that. And in all three of them, I felt like they were rule breakers. At least one half of the couple, often the woman in the relationship, was sort of testing these boundaries, was sort of trying to figure out if they could test those boundaries without repercussion, and sometimes, you know, with really negative results, wanted more freedom. And in many cases, the other half, her husband, wasn't necessarily happy with that. And that's something that you are seeing play out quite a lot in India right now.
I mean, does it tell us a lot about the evolution of women's roles in Indian society more broadly? Is this sort of are we looking at a new development in Indian feminism, if you will, or is that not really you're seeing right now?
I mean, even if you look at the Me Too movement in the U.S. right now, that sort of moment happened in India 5 years ago with the 2012 gang rape of a student, which brought thousands of women out into the streets calling for change. And there was some legislative change as a result. And obviously, there's still a long way to go. But you definitely see sort of a rising tide of feminism and female agency in India. And, you know, it's happening faster at maybe higher economic classes, perhaps. But you do see it across the board. You do see these changes. And that's something that I saw in all three of the women in these couples, was the desire for more freedom, more independence, more of a voice than perhaps their mothers were able to have. So, for example, one of the characters, one of the people in the book, Maya, you know, she, as she went to got educated and went to work and grew up in this time, she very much wanted something different than her mother from her husband. She wanted companionship from him. She wanted his time and not just his financial support. That's something that she was really frustrated to find that he was not willing to give. I talk about her and other women looking at pornography and looking outside of their marriages for happiness. And the consequences for those things can be very extreme.
Early on in the book, you mentioned, I think it's in the introduction, where you mentioned that you are a white woman who decided to take on reporting this topic.
Right.
Why did you think it was important to say that early on?
Well, I think, you know, any person who's trying to write about a country not their own should be very aware of the weaknesses that come with that and the maybe myopia and the things you can miss. And I also, as a journalist and just as a reader, had noticed that much of the coverage of India that I've always read has either tended towards the salacious or sort of exoticizing India. And living in India and reporting there, I was sort of frustrated that that was most of what we got about India in the West. And I didn't want to do that in my own reporting, and sort of felt like it was really important all the time to be aware that I was an outsider and try to figure out the ways in which I could overcome those stumbling blocks, but also maybe the way that an outsider perspective could see something that maybe others couldn't who lived inside of it. So
we'd love to hear you read from the book. Can you set this up and tell us who we're hearing about?
Yes, so we're hearing about Ashok and Parvati. They're a newly married couple. Parvati had fallen in love and wanted to marry the person she loved. Her parents didn't allow her to. They told her she could choose someone else within their parameters, which involves someone being from their same background, but also being Hindu and also being Brahmin from the upper caste. And so she, among those in those parameters, chose Ashok, and the scene is from the beginning of their marriage and the tremendous difficulties that Parvati is facing adjusting to this semi-arranged marriage after having wanted to marry the person she loved. Parvati got better. Parvati got worse. Whenever she had a bad meltdown, Ashok called it a crying jag. One day he heard Parvati crying so loudly, he knew it was going to be the worst jag she'd had yet. From the Oxford Dictionary's jag, a sharp projection, origin, late Middle English, in the sense stab, pierce, perhaps symbolic of sudden movement or unevenness. The jag started after Parvati got off the phone with Ashok's family members. As she spoke to them, she realized how foreign they still felt. She hadn't chosen them, not really. She hardly knew them, and she didn't feel connected to them at all. The more she thought about it, the more upset she got. After hanging up, she went inside her room and began to sob. "What's up, Chibu?" Ashok said, coming into their bedroom. Recently, someone had told them that the name of their suburb meant drama or hysterics in the Gujarati language. "My life since moving here has been all drama and hysterics," he thought. Parvati looked up at him now. Who is this person? He was just a blank space, a space barely filled in over the last year. He was a stranger, one she had traded for her father.
Elizabeth, I think one of the things that's interesting to me to think about is this idea of arranged marriages, right? I think we hear about it. It's one of the biggest stereotypes when we think about Indian marriages in particular. Are they often happy or unhappy in your research?
I mean, it depends on so many things. But in this case, it was interesting to me because as I was finishing my research and interviews with them, I was talking to Parvati about she had just gotten pregnant, about their child, and she said, you know, I'm going to obviously have an arranged marriage for my daughter. And I was shocked to hear this because I had spent years with her in which there was so much unhappiness in having to have had a semi-arranged marriage. But what I think happened over time with Ashok and Parvati is that she, as often is the case in arranged marriages, adjusted her expectations and found some really positive things about marrying Ashok and marrying someone her parents were approved of, which was stability, knowing that this person wasn't going to leave her, knowing that there wasn't going to be upheaval in her family or his family over their relationship. And, you know, we can cast aspersions on that, or we can say that that's not a good thing. But she very strongly at the end sort of said, I want the same thing for my child.
And that's interesting because we earlier talked about the fact that women, Indian women in particular, are having more agency. They're making more of their own decisions in terms of relationships. Did any of the women you interviewed feel like this, that arranged marriages diminished their agency or their sense of choice or self?
Oh, absolutely. And there are many women who are defying their parents and having love marriages and running away. And one of the couples in the book does that, and they dramatically go to Jaipur and take planes to meet each other and get married under the cover of night, and absolutely will not give in to an arranged marriage and threaten suicide and truly feel like they would want to die if they had to have an arranged marriage. So it does run the gamut, and there are a lot of women who feel different kinds of ways about this. But I think what was interesting to me about Parvati was that while women, you know, she started out saying that she would never give in to an arranged marriage, it sort of was an indication to me that while things are changing, they're not changing necessarily as fast as we think that they might be.
And obviously, I'm wondering if there are any cultural parallels, because we're talking about things as universal as relationships and love, that you saw that are emerging in India among this middle class group of people that you talk to that are parallel to what could be happening here in the United States. Are there cultural parallels? Are there relationship parallels? Are there connections that you saw that, regardless of race, gender, background, are more universal in terms of relationships?
Yeah. Well, I actually think the way that arranged marriages are changing in India is not so far flung from how our online dating looks in the U.S. today. I mean, BharatMatrimony.com, which is probably the biggest online arranged matchmaker, is really quite a lot like Tinder. In, you know, we might look at it as very different in that the parents of a couple might still play a role, but the children themselves are increasingly playing a role in those matches. And it is sort of finding a person that matches up to you in X, Y, and Z ways. And it is sort of cycling through a lot of different options and feeling like there's thousands of people out there, and this sort of paradox of choice where there's too many, and it makes you feel uncertain about what you want. But I think there's this tendency over here to look at arranged marriages with horror, or just sort of disbelief that that could ever work. But what I've found in India is there is this sort of new hybrid half-love, half-arranged marriage emerging, where maybe there's some parental input, but people are really choosing who they're going to marry themselves, or they're maybe narrowing down the pool, and then their parents are participating. And so far, you know, one of the marriages I followed in this book followed that model, and I myself was skeptical of it first, but they seem quite happy. And they felt like a lot of the stumbling blocks that are faced in a marriage, they sort of overcame early on by both agreeing to the marriage themselves and having their wider community of people also supporting it.
We're in the season of Valentine's Day, and so just to sort of end on an up note, are there any universal themes of love that came out of your research in this book that just apply to love in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think something that I learned personally from watching these marriages is that no matter how bad a relationship can get, and no matter how difficult things can be, that, and I would sometimes feel like I was giving up on these couples myself and worrying that things were really over, that they still, all of them, there were moments of grace and moments where they made each other laugh so much that their stomach hurt or they fell over. And I think in love, that's a really important thing. And I guess the other takeaway I would want to mention is just about expectations. I mean, we so often in love have these tremendously high expectations of the person we're with. And I think some of the best relationships I saw were when, it sounds simple but difficult to do, is when a couple sort of met the other person where they were. Not to say that you would let them get away with anything, but that you sort of accepted a person for who they were. So, yeah, happy Valentine's Day.
So we're hopeful about love at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm still hopeful.
That's a good thing to be. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Elizabeth Flock is a reporter for PBS NewsHour and author of the new book, The Heart is a Shifting Sea, Love and Marriage in Mumbai. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.